food is discarded. She asks if I have a bucket and mop. Please don't clean the floor. Just the kitchen. I watch her from the sofa. You should eat more fresh fruit and vegetables, she says, commenting on the contents of the fridge. Are you a good cook? Not really. I can show you how to make some of Hayden's favourites. Great. She tackles the bathroom next, yelling questions, asking about my family, where I'm from and where I went to school. I try to remember what I told her the last time. Is your mother excited about being a grandmother? Not really. Why not? I think the label granny rather bothers her. It does tend to age a woman. Mrs. Cole won't let me see what she's brought me until the cleaning is finished. Pulling off her rubber gloves, she brushes hair from her eyes and takes a seat on the sofa, opening each bag in turn. The first has a dressing gown and nightdress. Something to wear to the hospital, she explains. The next bag contains a baby's blanket, cardigans, socks and knitted hats. I wasn't sure if you were going with blue for a boy, so I went for neutral colours. Boys are lovely. So are girls, but it's always nice to get a boy first up. Mrs. Cole finds nice things to say about my flat and asks where the baby will sleep. I thought I'd buy a Moses basket. Good idea, she declares. I can take you shopping. What about a pram? She asks. I'm borrowing one. I could get you a new one. It's not right that you pay. Of course it is. We want to help. Fully settled in, she continues to talk about the birth, telling me not to worry about the money. I wish she'd leave. I need to think about Hayden and what I'm going to do. I have 14 days until he arrives home. He'll want to see me. He'll want proof that he's the father. Sometimes it's best not to know how babies are made. Megan. Grace wants to throw me a baby shower, which I think is tacky third time around. We're sitting in the kitchen watching Lachlan's attempts to fly a homemade kite in the garden. He fashioned it out of a pizza box, and it has less chance of getting airborne than our lawn flamingo. Don't be such a spoilsport, says Grace. Every baby should be celebrated. What if I don't feel like a party? That would make you a grouch. For a brief moment, perhaps craving her sympathy, I contemplate telling her about Simon, but instantly dismiss the notion. No gifts, I stipulate. What about baby clothes? I have boxes of clothes in the attic. Second-hand stuff, she pouts. Please don't make him wear hand-me-downs. That's what happened to me. I had to wear your old stuff. Second-hand school uniforms, hand-me-down shoes, tennis rackets, ski jackets. I remember one Christmas, I was 9, Mum and Dad bought me a pair of boots. They were the first new shoes I'd ever owned. I want to laugh and make some wisecrack about first world problems, but I can see she's being serious. Grace has always resented being the second child. She doesn't accept that being the youngest has any benefit. Maybe she has a point. Everybody celebrates a first baby. When Lucy was born, there were cards, flowers and toys from friends, family and colleagues. Lachlan didn't even get half that number. And when I look through our photographs, there are far more of Lucy than Lachlan. You had Mum and Dad to yourself, Grace says. When I came along, I had half their time. You had 3 people loving you. You had me. You weren't very nice to me. Remember that time you pushed me off a box in the garden and I broke my arm? Oh, my God, that was 1 time. Very caring. I signed your cast. Big whoop. Grace knows I'm teasing her. If you're so keen to have a baby shower, have your own baby, I say. My husband might come in handy. What about Darcy, her latest? He's on the way out. You've only just introduced him to the family. I think that's my problem. Once my family likes a guy, I go right off him.
Darcy is lovely.
He reminds me too much of Dad.
Is that a bad thing?
Yes, she pulls a face. The whole idea of getting married and having children terrifies me. What if becoming a parent doesn't make me grow up? It could be just a cheap disguise.
It's not cheap.
True.
Agatha. My memories are ruthless with the details of my life.
I cannot edit or alter or delete moments or rewrite the endings. I see my babies, the ones I lost or gave away, and I imagine different lives and better times, but cannot change what happened. Now I have another problem. Hayden will be home in 2 weeks. The creature is coiled around my lungs, making it hard to breathe. It is goading me, sometimes in a whisper, sometimes a shriek. I block my ears, telling it to go away.
Foolish, foolish.
It's not my fault.
You'll never be a mother.
I will. Getting out of bed, I shuffle to the wardrobe and dress in yesterday's clothes. The first grey hint of dawn brightens the eastern sky, revealing a rainy day after a soggy night. I'm not working today. Normally I'd stay in bed, but the creature won't let me rest. Turning on the TV, I watch the news headlines, followed by a perky weather girl who is paid to find rainbows on miserable mornings like this. At 9 o'clock, there's a knock on the door.
Who is it? I ask.
It's me, says Jules. She's dressed to go out, holding Leo's hand.
Have you been crying? She asks.
No.
Your eyes are red.
It must be hay fever.
At this time of year?
She ushers Leo into the flat. He's dressed in baggy jeans and a sweatshirt featuring Thomas the Tank Engine.
You said you'd look after him this morning, says Jules.
I have a doctor's appointment. Did you forget?
No, it's okay. You go.
Leo is hiding under her baby bump, holding on to her legs. Jules hands me a bag of colouring books, crayons and DVDs.
Come on, little man, I say. Let's watch some cartoons.
Jules leaves quickly before Leo can grow anxious. Sitting on the sofa, we watch TV until he grows bored.
Why don't you draw me a picture, I say, getting the crayons and paper.
20 minutes later, he's running around the flat wearing a cardboard box on his head, pretending to be an astronaut. He runs into a wall, cries. Kisses are dispensed.
I could just eat you up, I say.
He looks alarmed.
You can't eat me.
Why not?
I'm a boy.
But boys are so yummy. I chase him into the bedroom and catch him on the bed, blowing raspberries into his soft white tummy. Later I get him a biscuit and he cuddles up to me on the sofa.
Do you want some more milk?
He nods. I stand up and Leo points to the back of my denim skirt.
You spilled.
I look over my shoulder and see the patch of blood. The sofa has a smaller stain. Something small and fragile breaks inside me, as though I've run through a single strand of spider's web. My whole body cramps. I stare at the blood. My knees are shaking. Stumbling to the bathroom, I take off my skirt and knickers. Standing over the sink, I scrub at the stained fabric with soap and my bare hands, lathering and rinsing. The water grows pink. My hands are sore. I'm losing my baby.
You were never pregnant.
Shut up! Shut up!
I told you so.
I weep and pull at my hair, enjoying the pain. I rail at the unfairness, hating myself, wanting to do violence. I want to shove my fist inside myself and stop the flow of blood. Sitting on the edge of the bathtub, I hiccup and sob, letting my sodden skirt drip onto my socked feet. I hear a creak and glance up. Leo is watching me through a narrow gap in the door. I quickly grab the towel and try to cover myself, but he has pushed his way inside.
What's that?
He asks, pointing at my stomach.
It's where babies come from. My mummy doesn't have one of those.
Her baby is coming from somewhere else. I glance at the mirror and see a sad, half-naked clown wearing a ridiculous-looking silicon belly that is wrapped around my back. What a wretch I am. What a pathetic, pitiable excuse for a human being. I am a joke. I am an echo. I am a failure. The creature is right. What is the point of a barren woman? Leo reaches out and touches the prosthetic.
Do you have a baby in there?
That's right.
How did he get in there? God put him there.
Leo frowns. What's wrong? I ask.
My daddy put a baby in Mummy's tummy, says Leo. Did he put a baby in you, too?
I shake my head, wiping my eyes. Go back to the TV.
I'm thirsty.
I won't be long. When he's gone, I wash my thighs and take a tampon from the bathroom cabinet. I dress in fresh clothes, moving slowly, like an accident victim, testing for bruises or broken bones. I fetch Leo a drink of milk and join him on the sofa. He puts his hand on my belly, still curious.
The boy knows.
He's done nothing wrong.
He could tell someone.
Nobody will believe him.
Foolish girl.
Jules arrives home at midday, shaking out her umbrella.
It's horrible out there, she says, giving Leo a hug.
Was everything all right at the doctor's?
Fine.
She turns to Leo.
What do you see?
The little boy looks at me shyly.
Thank you for looking after me, Auntie Agatha.
Anytime, I reply. I hear them climbing the stairs, unlocking the door, Leo running across the sitting room. Jules goes to the bathroom. The toilet flushes, the cistern refills. Water soughs and gurgles down pipes in the walls. I envy Jules, feeling her baby grow inside her, listening to the heartbeat, watching the scans. I am not impetuous or impulsive by nature, nor am I a monster. But there are nights when I have lain awake, staring at the ceiling, contemplating how to drug my best friend and cut the baby from her womb. I would not do it. I could not do it. But I want to do it. I feel claustrophobic. I cannot breathe. Shrugging on my coat, I go downstairs, raising my hood against the spitting rain. My uterus cramps. My heart aches. My body is mocking me. The creature cackles.
I told you so. I told you so. I told you so.
I sing to myself, drowning out the voice, and keep walking, past the shops in the King's Road and Sloane Square, north towards Kensington and Marble Arch. London has an ominous gravity that makes every step seem heavier, like I'm climbing to the gallows. At an intersection, I spy a line of preschoolers in matching raincoats, lined up two by two, holding hands, waiting for the lights to change. Their teacher chaperones stand in front and behind. I think of Elijah, my baby brother, my first loss. At Kingdom Hall, I learned that envy is one of the seven deadly sins, but I am guilty of it on a daily basis. I envy the good-looking, the wealthy, the happy, the successful, the connected, and the married. But more than anything else, I envy the new mothers. I follow them into shops. I watch them in parks. I gaze longingly into their prams. My biological clock is broken and cannot be fixed. 12 fertility clinics turned me away over the past 4 years. I've had my turn, they said. One specialist at Hammersmith Hospital told me not to give up hope. I wanted to slap him and yell, "Hope! Hope doesn't make you pregnant. Hope whispers, one more time, but still disappoints. Hope is a good breakfast but a bad supper," my grandmother used to say. A psychotherapist said my desire for a baby was some sort of metaphor for something else missing in my life. "What do you mean?" I asked. "The birth is metaphorical. There is something that wants to be born that is not really a baby."
"Not a baby?"
"Yes." This is bullshit, I thought. "A baby isn't a metaphor. A baby is my reason for being born a woman. Why else was I given a womb and made to bleed every month? Why else do I feel so empty inside? Why else do I mourn the babies I've lost and the one I surrendered?" People who have children seem to regard infertility as being an outdated condition, like smallpox or the plague. They think it was cured long ago by IVF and surrogacy, and that anyone settling for childlessness is weak-willed and ignoble. They're wrong. Science offers no safety net. Only 1 in 4 fertility treatments results in a live birth, and once a woman reaches 35, the odds get even worse. I have blown those odds. I have tricked boyfriends, fucked strangers, stolen sperm, and undergone 5 rounds of IVF. But still my womb refuses to grow a mini-me. I have advertised for donor eggs, investigated adoption, and given up on international surrogacy because I could never afford the fees being asked by brokers, lawyers, and surrogates. I've tried to avoid baby showers, children's birthday parties, playgrounds, and school gates. It's not that seeing babies and children makes me unhappy. I love watching them. What makes me sad is listening to mothers sitting around, swapping stories, complaining about their sleepless nights or teething troubles, or the expenses or the germs or the tantrums. How dare they complain? They are blessed, chosen, lucky. My desire for a child is like a missing piece that cannot be substituted or replaced. It hurts, this hollow feeling, this empty womb, this baby-sized hole inside me. I feel it when I glimpse a baby or read a magazine or watch TV. I want a happy marriage, a house and a dog, but I will forego all of these for the chance to have and hold a child, to love, to cherish, to own, to raise, to belong. It's mid-afternoon and the light is already fading. Somehow I've reached the river near Westminster with no recollection of what roads I took or what corners I turned. Big Ben strikes the hour. Sitting on a painted wooden bench with a cast-iron base, I can smell the dampness on me. Light rain is still falling. A church bell rings, a bus passes, a jackhammer shudders. Gulls wheel above my head. London has no time for silence. It does not reflect upon its past. A barge passes me slowly, edging forward against the tide. A schoolboy stops and asks if I have a light. A soggy cigarette clings to his lips. He leaves. I stand. Numb with cold, I walk forward and peer at the river, frothing and boiling around the pylons. The world is enormous, and I am a tiny, unmemorable speck within it, easily lost, quickly forgotten. The creature uncoils inside me.
You could jump.
I'd probably fail.
You could slip beneath the surface and disappear.
My prosthetic would keep me afloat like a lifebuoy. I would bob along until someone pulled me out.
You could take it off.
Confusion creeps over me. I brace my hands against the stonework and lean over and out, rising onto my toes. I stare at the swirling water, wondering how cold it would be. At that moment, a Labrador puts its paws on the wall next to me, standing on its hind legs to peer at the same water. Wagging its tail and trembling with joy, it turns to me excitedly, as though asking me what I'm looking at. "Hello," I say. "Where did you come from?"
"I'm so sorry," says a voice.
An elderly man shuffles into view. He's carrying a dog leash and puffing.
"She got away from me. Get down, Betty. Leave the nice lady alone."
Betty licks at my hand.
"She won't bite," he says. "Is everything all right?"
I don't answer him.
"You're upset. Can I do anything?"
"No, please, just go." He clips the leash on Betty's collar and turns away. He doesn't go far. I see him speaking on his phone, looking at me. Meanwhile, a seagull has settled on the wall. It's an ugly fat thing with beady eyes and webbed feet and a hooked beak. I stare at the evil-looking bird, aware that the old man and his dog are still watching me. A police car pulls up behind them. A constable gets out, puts on his hat and approaches.
"Good afternoon,"
he says, addressing me cheerfully. I half expect him to add,
"Lovely day."
"That bird is evil," I say, motioning to the seagull.
"Pardon?"
"It's staring at me." He looks at the seagull, not understanding. Betty barks.
"I was the man who called," says the man.
I was worried about her. The officer steps nearer and puts his gloved hands on mine.
What's your name?
Agatha.
Are you cold, Agatha?
Yes.
How about we get you a cup of tea?
That's all right. I have to go home.
Where is home?
I point west along the river.
Have you been crying?
It's the rain.
When is your baby due? Asks the constable.
In 2 weeks. The officer nods. He is younger than I first thought. A silver wedding band glints on his ring finger.
What are you doing out here?
He asks. I went for a walk.
It's raining.
I like the rain. I must look a mess. I must sound crazy.
Do you have some form of identification?
I left my wallet in the car.
Where is your car?
Around the corner.
Okay, let's go to your car.
The plot holes are apparent, even as I come up with the plot. Sorry, I made a mistake. I don't have a car. I walked. I glance around me. I have to go. I'm due home.
Maybe you should let me take you,
he says, brushing raindrops off the shoulders of his jacket. No! He's waiting for me to say something more, but I can't begin to explain the misery of today. Turning his back, he talks into a shoulder radio. I hear the words agitated and doctor. Growing anxious, I look both ways along the pavement, but there's nowhere to run. I am such a wretched weakling, so easily thrown into turmoil, so quickly frightened and panicked. The creature laughs.
You're in trouble now.
Shut up! The constable turns.
Did you say something?
No.
I think you should come with me.
Where?
To the hospital.
I'm not sick.
I want the doctors to check out your baby.
He leads me to the police car.
Mind your head.
The last time I sat in a police car was when Elijah died. My mother sat next to me, and we waited for the coroner to finish looking at his body.
I'm PC Hobson,
he says, glancing at me in the mirror. He asks for my full name. I invent one. Agatha Baker. It sounds fake. I should have chosen a different one.
Where exactly do you live, Agatha?
He asks. In Leeds, I say. Another lie. I'm visiting my sister.
Where does she live?
Richmond.
What were you doing beside the river?
Nothing.
Has something upset you?
No, I'm fine. The police car pulls up in an ambulance bay at Chelsea and Westminster Hospital. The A&D department is on the ground floor. The waiting room is newly refurbished with polished wooden benches and bright green splashes of colour. The seats are taken by the walking wounded, the bandaged, broken-limbed and burned. They look very busy, I say. I could come back later.
We're here now,
says PC Hobson, ushering me to the reception desk. I fill out a form using my fake name and address. A triage nurse looks into my eyes with a pencil light. How many weeks? 38. What's your GP's name? Dr. Higgins. He's in Leeds. You seem to be carrying quite low. The nurse reaches for my stomach and I pull away. She frowns and tells me to pop into the next cubicle and slip on a gown. A doctor will be along soon. PC Hobson looks relieved.
Is there someone I can call? Your husband, perhaps?
He's away at sea. He's in the Royal Navy.
How about your sister?
She'll be at work. I'll call her. You don't have to stay. I disappear behind the curtain. The examination room has a trolley bed and shelves full of disposable gloves, antiseptic wipes and bandages. I can't stay here. I can't let them examine me. Before I can move, a doctor appears. He looks young and tired and clever.
You're not undressed?
He says. Sorry, I misunderstood. He puts on a pair of surgical gloves and glances at his notes. Agatha? I nod.
Do you know what you're having?
A boy.
When did you last feel him moving?
Just now. He's right as rain.
Any blood or spotting?
I flinch. No.
Contractions?
Twinges. The trick to lying is not to add superfluous details. Keep it simple. Don't elaborate or decorate. Are you going to touch me?
I'm going to check the baby's position, then I'll hook you up to a fetal monitor and we'll listen to his heartbeat.
Is that necessary?
Definitely.
I need to use the loo. He sighs impatiently. It's down the corridor, third door on the left.
Won't be long.
Taking my overcoat, I slip past him, along the corridor. Reaching the ladies, I duck inside a cubicle and try to steady my breathing. I can't go back. I can't let him touch me or see me naked. Easing open the door, I lean out and scan the busy corridor. Turning away from A&D, I walk purposefully past random nurses and white-coated doctors who don't appear to notice me. The corridor hits a junction. I turn right and then left. I pass a cleaner and a patient being wheeled by two orderlies. Reaching a dead end, I turn back. A nurse asks, "Are you lost?" I jump, startled. "I'm looking for the maternity ward." "You're on the wrong floor." "Of course. My sense of direction is hopeless." She shows me to the lifts where I press the button and wait, glancing over my shoulder to make sure she's gone. The doors open. "Are you getting in?" asks a middle-aged woman. "No, sorry." The doors close and I peel away, following the exit signs to the main entrance. Crossing the foyer, I keep waiting for someone to yell, "Stop!" The creature twists inside me, enjoying this.
"Run."
"I haven't done anything wrong."
"You faked a pregnancy."
"That's not against the law."
"They'll investigate. They'll find out about the others."
As I near the main door, I notice an overweight security guard in a grey uniform. He's pressing a walkie-talkie to his mouth. I keep my head down, not making eye contact. The automatic doors open. I turn along Fulham Road, shivering from the shock and the sweat and my rain-dampened clothes.
The creature is still talking. "They'll come looking for you."
I gave them a fake name and address.
"They'll find you anyway."
There is no Dr. Higgins in Leeds, and I don't have a sister in Richmond.
"What about the CCTV cameras?"
A bus is coming. I raise my arm and step on board, sliding down in my seat below the windowsill. I edge upwards and glimpse the police car still parked outside the hospital.
"Stupid, stupid, stupid."
Megan. Simon has sent me another bunch of flowers, tulips this time, along with a card apologizing for his behavior.
"Please forgive me, Meg. You're the last person in the world I would ever want to hurt. I hope you'll think about what I said. I love you, Meg, and I love Jack, but some things are more important than friendship."
I tell Jack the flowers came from a PR company that wants me to review a client's baby products on my blog. I should have thrown them away because they keep reminding me of Simon and what he said to me. In a bad mood, I pick a fight with Jack, which is completely unfair, because he's done nothing wrong. I complain about the nursery not being finished.
"You promised to help."
"I've been busy."
"You said that last week."
"I was busy then."
"Right, so shall I push the baby back? Tell him to wait until you're less busy?"
"I'll do it on the weekend."
"You're away this weekend."
"On Sunday."
Why is he being so reasonable? I want to yell, "Don't take my crap! Stand up for yourself!" Finally, I make some comment about Simon, saying, "At least he has a backbone."
"What does that mean?"
Jack asks. "Nothing. I don't want to talk about Simon."
"What has Simon done? You used to be friends."
"He makes me feel uncomfortable."
"How?"
"Forget it."
"Did he touch you?"
"No." I feel my body betraying me, blushing from my ankles to the top of my head. "It's the way he looks at me."
"How does he look at you?"
"I take it back. I shouldn't have said anything."
"You can't just take it back. He's Lucy's godfather. He's my oldest friend."
I stop talking, which finally makes Jack angry. He goes into the garden where he plucks leaves from a bush and throws them into the air as though wishing they were rocks. I feel guilty because I'm the one who deserves to be punished. I should be marched to the stocks or stoned like some biblical whore. After Jack leaves for work, I wallow in self-pity, listening to an interview on Woman's Hour. A mother whose baby girl disappeared 5 years ago is recounting what happened, her voice stripped bare and scoured by grief.
"I checked on Emily when I went to bed, and she was sleeping in her cot. Jeremy came home late and also looked in. She was still there. It was a hot night in August. We left the window open to catch the breeze. When I woke, it was almost 6. I thought Emily had finally slept through. I went to check on her, but the cot was empty. We've never given up hope of finding her alive, but we have to face the reality that with each passing year, our chances are fading. But I'm asking again for information, appealing for someone to come forward. With your help, we can end the torment of our uncertainty.
Lachlan has come into the kitchen.
Why are you crying, Mummy?
I'm not crying. Your eyes are leaking.
I touch my wet cheeks.
Did the baby make you cry?
He asks.
No.
I hug him, burying my face into his neck. He hugs me back as hard as he can.
Careful, you'll hurt the baby,
I say.
Can he feel me?
And he can hear you.
Would you like to tell him something? Lachlan frowns in concentration and puts his face down, pressing it against my swollen belly.
Don't make Mummy cry.
Agatha. There is no baby inside me. I am carrying an idea. I am nursing a dream. Many things can be stolen. Ideas, moments, kisses and hearts, to name just a few. I am going to steal a baby. I am going to take what I am owed, because others have more than enough. I am going to live the life I was meant to live, with a husband and a child. I can't remember the exact moment when I made the decision to fake a pregnancy. The idea seemed to germinate in darkness and grow slowly towards the light. I read a magazine story about a surrogacy arrangement where the new mother wore a prosthetic belly, hoping to share the experience with the birth mother. Not for the first time, I shoved a pillow under my pajama top and stood in front of the mirror, turning from side to side, smoothing my bump, imagining myself pregnant. I enjoyed the fantasy and began repeating it, adding more details each time. Going online, I discovered a website called My Fake Pregnancy, which sold 3 different sizes of prosthetic bumps, covering each trimester. Made from high-grade medical silicone, the bellies were supposed to look and feel like real skin. I read the testimonials from couples who used the prosthetics because they were adopting babies and wanted people to believe they were having their own. It took a week for my order to arrive. I began wearing the prosthetics around the flat, never outside. I bought maternity clothes and played dress-up, feeding my fantasy with more and more real-world details, looking at nursery furniture and baby catalogues. At first, I simply wanted to feel pregnant and imagine a baby growing inside me. Later, I wanted people to look at me differently. I wanted to be blessed, special, doted upon. When I met Hayden, I hid the prosthetic bumps away and hoped he might fall in love with me. He was kind and considerate and just handsome enough not to stray too far. I could imagine being his wife and having his child. Jules fell pregnant, and I celebrated even as I cried inside. I envied her swollen ankles and her sticky-out navel and her bliss. Hayden had gone back to his ship. I found the fake bellies in the back of the wardrobe and strapped on the largest size. Was that when I decided? Perhaps. Not all ideas come fully formed or from a single source. Often there are no light bulb moments or crashes of thunder. Faking a pregnancy isn't difficult. It helped having Jules living so close. First, I drained the water from my toilet and sabotaged the system so it wouldn't flush. Then I invited Jules downstairs and plied her with cups of tea until she had to use my bathroom.
Your toilet is broken, she said. It won't flush.
It's being temperamental.
Do you want Kevin to look at it?
No, Mrs. Brindle should call a plumber. After Jules had gone, I dipped a jar into the toilet bowl. A little icky, I know, but when needs must.
The next day I went to see an out-of-area GP and sat in his waiting room amid coughing infants and crumbling old people, rehearsing a story in my head. Dr. Bailey ushered me into a consulting room that smelled of alcohol swabs and hand wash. He had thinning hair and bushy eyebrows that made his forehead seem enormous. I wondered if his brain expanded to fill the space, or if it rattled around like a walnut in a saucepan.
"So this is your first visit," he said, looking at his notes. "How do I pronounce your surname?"
"Feifel."
"And what can I do for you, Miss Feifel?"
"I think I might be pregnant."
"How late are you?"
4 weeks.
"Have you taken a test?"
"I didn't know how accurate they were."
"Very."
He rolled his chair across the floor to a small bank of drawers, producing a syringe in sealed plastic.
"I can do a blood test."
"No, no, not a needle," I said, covering my arms. "I faint at needles, ever since I was a little girl."
He reached into a different drawer and handed me a jar. "The women's room is just down the hall. Fill this up for me and I'll do a pregnancy test."
Inside the toilet cubicle, I opened my bag and pulled out the bottle containing the sample I collected from Jules. After swapping the contents, I washed my hands and went back to Dr. Bailey's office.
"Well, you're definitely pregnant," he said, showing me the stick. "You won't see a pinker line than that one."
"You're sure?"
"These tests are never wrong."
He signed a letter confirming that I was pregnant and told me to see my own GP, who would schedule an ultrasound and give me my dates. I took the letter home and pinned it to the fridge. Later, I showed it to the girls at the supermarket, who were all excited for me, maybe even a little jealous, which I could understand. I had been very diligent since then. No alcohol or soft cheeses or sushi or mayonnaise, and I've put the bungee jumping and skydiving on hold. If anyone lights up a cigarette nearby, I glare at them and hold my swollen belly. In that first trimester, I complained of morning sickness until the nausea seemed real, and I slipped away to the staff toilet, retching into the bowl. Abigail held back my hair and fetched me water, telling me to sip it slowly. Mr. Patel grumbled that I was avoiding the heavy jobs and disappearing to the toilet whenever he had a chore. I tried to explain to him about increased blood supply to the pelvic area and pressure on the bladder creating the urge to pee, but he covered his ears and retreated. When I first wore a prosthetic belly outside, the smallest size, I felt self-conscious, but now it's become part of me. I wear tight-fitting dresses and proudly arch my back as I walk along the street, letting the world know that I am with child. At 20 weeks, I downloaded ultrasound pictures from the internet. I doctored them up with my name and national insurance number, making them look official. I showed them around work and stuck them on the fridge beside my favourite photograph of Hayden. By then, I was so confident, I wore my fake belly with summer dresses and silk blouses. Days and weeks went by when I lost myself in the dream. I felt the baby growing inside me. He kicked and hiccuped and rolled while I stroked my belly and spoke to him. I'm on the biggest size now, the third trimester version, and I love the looks I get from random strangers who smile at me as though I'm their favourite niece or daughter-in-law. For months, I told myself, I could stop at any time. I could miscarry or move away from London, beginning my life somewhere else. But a small, irrational part of me hoped I could keep the deception going forever. Impossible, I know. A clock has been set running inside me, an hourglass with trickling sand. I have less than 2 weeks to go. Come that time, I will have to lose my baby, or find one. Megan. I'm at a yoga class for pregnant women at a studio beneath Barnsbridge Station. I know most of the women, although each week we lose a few mothers as their babies arrive. The instructress is also pregnant, wearing a leotard so sheer and tight I can see her outie belly button. Her sleeveless vest has a cartoon drawing of a scowling pregnant woman and the caption, "The word you're looking for is radiant." Speaking with breathless fervour, she exhorts us to inhale,
Exhale. Inhale. Exhale. Start to find your breath. Become more conscious of it. Inhale. Exhale. Use my voice as a guide.
I look past her at my reflection in the mirror. The only time I see my toes is at these yoga classes.
Now take one hand to your precious baby, the other hand to your heart. Allow your lungs to expand and gently draw your baby towards you, like you're giving him or her a hug.
I like these sessions, the stretching bits and meditation, not the New Age babble about self-exploration, emotional balance or surrendering to a higher being. The trick, I've decided, is to add the science and subtract the spiritual.
Inhale. Exhale. Two more breaths. That's right. Now come back to center and get on all fours for a prenatal sun salutation.
On my hands and knees, I feel more like a cow than ever. I look past my bump and notice Agatha at the back of the class. I give her a little wave. She smiles nervously.
One arm to the leg, the other behind you. Inhaling and exhaling. Keep moving with the breath. Your body is bedding down your baby and creating a beautiful home.
I roll my eyes, and Agatha copies me. I look for her after the class. She's brushing her hair and pulling it into a ponytail. I haven't seen you here before, I say. I try to hide at the back, she replies. We're both wearing the same brand of leggings and sports top. We could be twins, I say. Except I do yoga like a hippo. She's funny. How about that coffee? I ask.
Me?
Sure, my treat. It's the least I can do after you found Lachlan. He was never really missing, Agatha says. He was always safe. In the storeroom. I know, but I still don't understand how the door locked behind him.
No,
says Agatha, who changes the subject. Let's have coffee at Gale's, unless you want to go somewhere else. She looks at me hopefully.
No, I love Gale's.
We grab our bags and push through the swinging doors. Clusters of women are chatting on the footpath, dangling keys from manicured fingers. Across the road, the river smells of low tide, and fat-bottomed boats are marooned on the mud, canted drunkenly sideways. Turning onto Barnes High Street, we pass rows of speciality shops, boutiques, and property agencies. The butcher waves to me. A schoolmother smiles and nods.
You seem to know everyone, says Agatha.
It's a village, I say, but there isn't much privacy. At the cafe we decide to sit inside, out of the cold wind. Automatically the conversation turns to babies. What else is there when we're both so near? Pregnancy, prenatal classes, obstetricians, pain relief. I'm booked for a cesarean, I say. Otherwise I'll tear again.
Tear?
Down there. I motioned to my lap. Lucy and Lachlan had big heads and I have a small pelvis. Agatha grimaces. You'll be fine. It's amazing how far we women can stretch.
Did it hurt?
Christ, yes. But you forget about that afterwards. That's why we do it all over again.
So you know the day?
December 7th.
How long will you be in hospital?
4 or 5 days. I pour my peppermint tea.
Where are you having yours?
Wait, you told me. Leeds. My mother lives there. She's going to be with me. So there's no chance your fiancé can get home. Agatha shakes her head. I'll make sure there are lots of photographs. It's not the same thing, though, is it? I say. When Lucy was born, Jack said he wanted to stay at the top of the bed, holding my hand because he didn't want to see the business end. But when push came to shove, and I mean that literally, he was down there, giving me a blow-by-blow account. He called it like a penalty shootout at the World Cup. Agatha laughs. She has a pretty face and a bashful smile, as though embarrassed or fearful of making a mistake. She asks me how I met Jack and how long we've been married. Like everyone else, she seems impressed that he works on TV. It's not as glamorous as you think, I say. He's away most weekends, and he missed our last two wedding anniversaries because of European Cup qualifiers. My birthday falls during the Tour de France, so he misses that as well. How long does he go away? 3 weeks for the tour. I get boozy telephone calls from French bars or bistros every night. Men have no idea, says Agatha, whose sweater is covered in pastry crumbs. Do you ever worry about him being away from home, or that temptation? I used to, I say, but he's a keeper. I sound confident, but occasionally I have pictured Jack partying with those skimpy-clad models in Lycra shorts and sponsors' T-shirts, who stand on the podium with the stage winners. I don't say this to Agatha, I've never said it to Jack, but I know he loves me. Is he excited about the baby? Asks Agatha. It took him a while. Why? This is our oops baby. We hadn't planned on having another one. Really? Agatha seems surprised by the news. We order more drinks and keep talking. How about you? I ask. Where did you go to school? Leeds mainly, she says. But really all over the place. I ran away from home when I was 15. Why? I didn't get on with my stepfather. Did you go back? I went into foster care. But your mother, we're friends now. What about after school? I went to secretarial college, says Agatha, making it sound very underwhelming. But I did once do a course to become a makeup artist. Mostly I did weddings and parties. Anyone famous? God, no. I've never met anyone famous. Not like you. What makes you think I've met famous people? Agatha's mouth opens, but no sound comes out. There is an awkward pause. Jack works in TV, I just assumed, she mumbles. I laugh, hoping she might relax. I used to work for a magazine. I once interviewed Jude Law. What was he like? Asks Agatha. Very handsome and very cheeky. Did he flirt with you? I think maybe he did. He fancied you. He wouldn't look twice at me now. Agatha. I marvel at how Meg can transform herself from a ponytailed, lycra-clad gym bunny into a sophisticated modern wife and mother. Next to her, I feel as clumsy and frumpy as a pantomime horse. Meg ordered the peppermint tea and a fruit salad, the healthy choice. I chose a large cappuccino and chocolate eclair that has flaked all over my sweater, which is knitted from such wiry wool that it foils any attempt to brush the crumbs away. It's so nice to see someone enjoy her food, says Meg, not meaning to tease me. I'm such a klutz. So am I. No, you're not. You would be amazed at how much baby food I managed to get in my hair. Yes, but that's not your fault. A trio of teenage schoolgirls pass the cafe, wearing lip gloss and eyeliner, and their skirts rolled up an inch or two, showing off their legs. I used to have a body like that, says Meg, sounding mournful. Lucky you. Shush, I think pregnancy suits you, she says. That's because I've grown into my body, I reply. Right now I feel decidedly unsexy and unlusted after. I don't think unlusted is a word, you know what I mean. Meg keeps asking me questions, and I swing between the truth and lies, rarely answering her directly. Lying comes very naturally to me, while the truth is awkward and uncomfortable, like ill-fitting shoes. It's not that I set out to be manipulative or cunning, and the lies I tell others are nothing compared to the ones I tell myself. Meg talks about growing up in Fulham and going to a private girls' school in Hammersmith. Any brothers or sisters? I ask. A sister, Grace. How about you? I did have a half-brother, but he died when he was 5. What happened? He was killed in a car accident. That's terrible. How old were you? 11. Meg tells me more about Grace, making her out to be a rebel. I'm expected to disclose similar intimacies about my upbringing. Why do casual conversations inevitably turn to childhood? I know that friends share memories like this, but why should I have to reveal details of siblings, punishments, pets, holidays, hijinks, broken bones or broken hearts, or who has the craziest mother? What about you, Agatha? She asks. What do you do in your spare time? I laugh nervously. My life is boring. People who say that always have the best stories. Not me. I try to deflect her again. Meg notices. I don't want her thinking I'm secretive. I was married once, I say, and begin telling her about Nicky. It lasted 5 years, but didn't work out. Are you still friends? He sends me a Christmas card every year. And you didn't have children. My eyes swim and the cafe blurs. I lower my head, unable to get the words out. I've upset you, says Meg. I'm sorry. No, it's my fault, I say. I thought after all this time... I don't finish. Start again. We lost a baby. A little girl. I miscarried at 5 months. That's awful. It shouldn't still affect me, but it does. You didn't try again? She asks. Something instantly comes alert inside me. I've revealed too much. Shared truths that will make it harder. Meg seems to sense my disquiet. Well, that's all in the past. Now you have a fiancé and a baby on the way. She smiles. Have you set a date for the wedding? Not yet. Maybe next summer. Perfect. We're thinking of honeymooning in Tahiti, I add, hoping to impress her. I hear the South Pacific is beautiful. We're going to get a bungalow on the beach and live like natives. How romantic, says Meg. Lucky you. Her face suddenly lights up as though she's had a brilliant idea. What are you doing now? What? Right now? Nothing. You should come home with me. I have boxes and boxes of baby clothes to sort through, far more than I need. Please take some. I don't need clothes. At least have a look. Some of them are brand new. I get free samples because of my blog. What blog? I write a little mummy blog about being pregnant and bringing up kids. Come back to the house. I'll make lunch. You can help me decide what to keep. Outside, the sky has darkened and the wind picked up, snapping at the canvas awnings and rattling windows. Fat drops begin dotting the pavement. I don't have an umbrella, says Meg. Neither do I. We'll have to run for it. I laugh. Are you serious? We're in no condition to run. Waddle, then. Meg runs ahead of me, holding her gym bag over her head as the rain gets heavier, falling in sheets. Shoppers are sheltering in doorways and unfurling umbrellas. Laughing and splashing through puddles, she yells, "The house isn't far!" If I run too quickly, I'm worried my belly will slip or the elastic backing will stretch. By the time I arrive at the house, Meg has unlocked the front door and kicked off her shoes. She gets two large towels from the linen cupboard. Giggling like schoolgirls, we dry our hair. Meg looks like Andy McDowell in Four Weddings and a Funeral. I look like Janet Leigh in Psycho before the knife starts shredding the shower curtain. I pull off my sodden sweater and notice my long-sleeved top is clinging to me like a second skin, revealing the outline of the prosthetic belly where it wraps around my back. A breath catches in my throat. I hold the towel against me. Do you have any dry clothes I could borrow? You bet. Come upstairs. I let Meg go first. I don't want her seeing me from behind. I know the layout of the house. The main bedroom is on the first floor overlooking Cleveland Gardens. Meg opens her wardrobe and collects leggings and sweaters. Without a moment's hesitation, she peels off her gym top. Her swollen belly is silhouetted in the light from the window. She unhooks her sports bra and turns towards me. I notice her linea nigra, the slight discoloration of her skin that runs from above her navel to her pubic bone. Her nipples are the same color. Get changed before you die of cold, she says. Can I use the bathroom? She points to the bathroom. I scoop up the dry clothes and shut the door behind me. Meg calls out, I'm sorry, Agatha. I should have asked. I'm always getting my kit off in front of other women at the gym. That's all right. I reply. It's almost like I want to show off, she says. God knows why. I'm the opposite, I say, yelling through the closed door. I take off my wet clothes, trying not to look at myself in the mirror. I quickly get dressed, making sure the prosthetic is fitted properly. I'm taking too long. Is everything okay? Asks Meg. Fine. Do you need a hairdryer? She yells. No, I'm okay. Well, I'm just going up to the attic to get the baby clothes. I'll meet you downstairs. Once she's gone, I open the bathroom cabinet and look through Meg's moisturizer and night creams, making a mental note of the brands. She and Jack have matching electric toothbrushes. Back in the main bedroom, I open drawers, looking at Meg's lingerie and underclothes. Tucked at the very back of her knicker drawer, I discover a small pink vibrator in a velvet pouch. Cute, sexy, modern. Wandering along the landing, I come to the nursery, which smells of fresh paint. Admiring the furnishings and stencils, I sit in the rocking chair and pivot back and forth, imagining that I'm nursing my baby. Meg calls me to come downstairs. She's warming a quiche in the oven and has made a salad. Once we've eaten, we spend 2 hours sorting through boxes of clothes, styling baby outfits and mentally playing dress-up. Meg talks about making friends and choosing the right day nursery in primary school. "Does Lucy like St. Osmond's?" I ask. "How do you know she's going there? I've seen her school uniform." "You've seen Lucy?" Meg frowns. "I've been working at the supermarket, remember? I've seen you coming and going with Lucy and Lachlan. I didn't know their names, of course. But if I'm right, Lachlan has a brightly coloured scooter, and Lucy likes her hair in round buns. She wants to be Princess Leia." "Who? Didn't you ever watch Star Wars?" "A long while ago." Meg looks at her mobile. "Speak of the little devils. I have to pick them up." The rain has stopped. My wet clothes have been tumble dried. Baby clothes are neatly folded in polished paper bags. Meg walks me to the front door. "When are you going up north?" "Next week." "Will I see you before then?" "I don't know." "You have my phone number. Here's my email." She writes her address on a scrap of paper. We hug. Our bellies bump. "If I don't see you, best of luck," Meg says. "You too. Send me pictures." "Okay." She stands at the door and waves goodbye. I walk along the road, not looking back, but wanting to. I knew Meg and I would be friends. I kept picturing us together, playing tennis and organizing picnics, and discussing what schools the kids should attend. At the same time, I have to be careful, because nothing is sewn up, or surefire, or open and shut. It's not over until the fat lady has a baby. Megan. "I made a friend today," I say. Jack is sitting on the bed, lacing up his tennis shoes. He and Simon have booked a court at the Roehampton Club. "Someone in my yoga class."
"So she's pregnant?"
"Obviously."
"You're like the mummy whisperer," Jack chuckles. "You attract them with that blog of yours."
"They're not friends, they're followers."
"Disciples, you mean?"
Jack has no idea about social media and the difference between friends, followers, likes and subscribers. He checks the grip of his tennis racket and practices his forehand.
"So who is she?"
"She works at the supermarket." He looks surprised. "What's wrong with that?"
"Your usual friends don't work in supermarkets."
"Agatha is refreshingly down to earth, and she makes me laugh. I thought I might introduce her to my mother's group."
"The Coven?"
"Very funny. This is her first baby, and her fiancé is away at sea."
"Is he a fisherman?"
"In the Royal Navy."
"Ah, a sailor."
"Why do you say it like that?"
"You know what they say about sailors."
"What?"
"There was this one sailor who was away 6 months at sea. When he finally reached port, he visited a brothel, put down 200 quid and said, 'Give me your ugliest woman and a grilled cheese sandwich.' The brothel madam replied, 'Sir, for that sort of money you could have our prettiest girl and a 3-course meal. The sailor said, 'Listen, lady, I'm not horny, I'm homesick.'"
Jack snorts with laughter. "That's terrible," I say.
"The best ones are." He pecks me on the lips. "I thought I might invite Simon back for dinner. Gina's away, so he's looking after himself."
I feel something shift inside me as though a tremor has set off an alarm that jangles in my ears. "Did he invite himself?" I ask, struggling to hear my words above the internal noise.
"No, but he's always asking about you."
"Me?"
"About your pregnancy. Maybe he's angling to be godfather again. Can he do that?"
I don't answer. Jack is almost at the front door. "We're only having leftovers. You should eat at the club," I say.
"Nonsense. Simon wants to see you. We'll order takeaway. Whatever happened between you two has to be sorted out."
I say nothing. The front door closes.
My heart beats like a blown tire. I told Simon he wasn't welcome. Why is he doing this? Opening the fridge, I spy a half-drunk bottle of white wine. I contemplate